Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
In this edition of Africa Link, the British government considers more military support to the French-led intervention in northern Mali.
I think they would be very reluctant to commit to combat troops in the way that the French have done. But the fact that David Cameron has made such a strong sort of public statement on it may be designed to give him a bit of political space so that if he felt that that was necessary, he could do so later.
Former Liberian President Charles Taylor appeals his conviction on war crimes charges and causes a political storm in Monrovia by demanding a pension as an ex-president.
So he has the right to receive all benefits according to our constitution. Even if you are convicted, you still have right home. You still have right home, you have family.
And in our feature Africa on the Move, Zambia takes the front line in fighting cancer. Hello and welcome to Africa Link, the program that brings you top stories and more from across the continent. I'm Crispin Wakideo in Bonn.
Top story.
To go or not to go? That is the question. British Prime Minister David Cameron told the House of Commons on Monday his government is considering giving more help to French forces fighting Islamist militants in Mali.
We will work with the Malians themselves, with their neighbours and with our international allies to prevent a new terrorist haven developing on Europe's doorstep. Mr. Speaker, we support the French intervention that took place at the request of the Malian government, and we are working to ensure that an African-led military force can, with the appropriate training and support, help to ensure Mali's long-term stability.
The Premier reiterated that this support would not include combat troops, but he vowed to show iron resolve in tackling Islamic terrorism after 37 foreigners, including at least three Britons, were killed following the recent attack by Islamist gunmen on a gas plant in the Algerian desert. So what kind of support is Britain willing to give to Mali? I put that question to Paul Melly, Associate Fellow at the Africa Programme, Chatham House in London.
Well, I think the support primarily will be either logistical, as the British are already providing with transport planes, or intelligence, surveillance, possibly drones, all that kind of stuff. I do not think at this stage that the British are planning to combat forces on the ground. But, of course, what we don't know is the technical details of what they would do in the background. I think they would be very reluctant to commit to combat troops in the way that the French have done. But the fact that David Cameron has made such a strong sort of public statement on it may be designed to give him a bit of political space so that if he felt that that was necessary, he could do so later.
And why is Britain ruling out any ground offensive even before they embark on this support?
Because Britain is already very heavily committed in Afghanistan and is just embarking on the wind down of its military presence there. Many British soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan and many others have been injured. It's been a very big, long-term, sustained commitment, and that, of course, followed Iraq. So politically, it would be quite difficult for the British government to then commit forces all over again to another region and in an operation that the public would perceive as very risky, even if a military assessment was that the risks were lower than in the theatres where British military forces have already been employed.
Why is Britain all of a sudden deliberating on a stronger military presence in northern Mali?
Britain isn't, when I say military presence, I think we should be very clear here. We're not, as far as anyone knows, talking about military forces on the ground. We're talking about backup support for the French and West African and Malian army operations. But the reason is because the security of northern Mali is critical to the security of West Africa, and the security of West Africa and the Sahara is a major crucial interest for Europe, and not just France, but all European Union countries. This is really not very far from Europe. Nigeria, for example, is not that far from Mali and is, after all, a major source of oil. There are big British and French and other European economic and political interests in the long-term stability of West Africa, which is a region that has made quite a lot of progress towards stability and economic growth over recent years. And from a British point of view, it's very important that that process is maintained.
The British government wants to trim down the country's military expenditure by shedding up to 5,000 soldiers. Can it afford another mission in Mali?
Well, that is why I suspect that the British government wouldn't want to deploy combat troops and wouldn't want to deploy very large numbers of forces. There's a very big difference, after all, between allocating a few planes to fly between Paris and Bamako, or between French military bases and Bamako, transporting equipment and troops, and providing some support with surveillance and intelligence. That may be an operation that employs 100 or 200 people who are already there, as it were, in the force infrastructure. That's quite different from deciding to send thousands of combat troops.
Associate Fellow at the Africa Programme of Chatham House, Paul Melly, on the line from London. Now, it's been almost 2 weeks since the start of a French military intervention in Mali, but approval for France is apparently undiminished. Instead, the former colonial power, which previously used to be hated and criticised by its former African colonies, is now being hailed. However, many Malians are living in fear. Some of them, who have family members in the north, have no idea of how their relatives are coping. This report by Catherine Gensler has been adapted for Africa Link by Sarah Stephan.
Mama La and his friends are waiting in front of the Hotel La Minitie, an ugly building in Bamako city centre. As soon as the traffic light changes to red, the boys start to move. Usually, they try to sell newspapers or other consumer items, but for some 2 weeks now, they have been selling the French national flag.
The French really have helped us a lot. We sell these flags because we appreciate France helping us in the fight against the rebels. That's how we celebrate them.
When people here spot a foreigner, they often yell, "Vive la France!" And it doesn't really matter whether they are actually French. They might be German citizens or Americans. Hopes are high that a French intervention is going to end the atrocities in Mali's north. That's how Oumou Traoré feels as well. The 34-year-old fled from Gao a couple weeks ago and made it to Bamako. She said she couldn't handle the situation in the north any longer.
I've seen a lot in the north. These armed outlaws raping women. They took everything from them.
That's what Mali's army, French troops, and the 3,300 ECOWAS soldiers are supposed to get rid of. Even Chad, which is not a member of ECOWAS, has said it will deploy 2,000 troops. Several European countries, Germany being one of them, help with logistics. By now, France likes to report its victories. Still, no one knows for how long this war will drag on. This uncertainty could lead to problems soon, says Alassane Dico from the Association of Deportees in Mali. Many Malians who fled from the north come to see him in his office.
Malians don't want a war that's dragging on. It's true, we're applauding the French army and are in favour of a military intervention. But Malians oppose a mission that's taking too long.
According to Dico, a military intervention won't be enough to solve the problems in Mali's north. At the moment, Oumou Traoré has other things to worry about. Her older brother and his family still live in Gao in Mali's north. But she doesn't know how he's doing. She hasn't heard from him in days. The mother of two tries to smile, but she can't bring herself to put on a happy face. Oumou Traoré admits,
I'm very worried about my family, which is still in the north. I worry about my older brother. I told them they should leave as fast as they can, but they are not able to. The roads are blocked off. I'm waiting now that they will come to Bamako via Niger and Burkina Faso.
That report by Catherine Gensler was presented by Sarah Stephan. And we will be returning to Mali later to hear how the conflict has affected popular music. Stay tuned.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
And the winner is? Not sure yet. Political parties in Kenya on Tuesday began unveiling the names of those who won stormy and chaotic primaries, which observers say were flawed. Many candidates claimed over the weekend that the process was unfair and that party bosses favoured certain contestants over others, leading to pockets of violent protest in Kenya's third largest city, Kisumu. Even though Monday was the deadline for filing party nomination lists, it is still unclear who the candidates are in several constituencies. From Nairobi, James Shimanyula reports.
With 6 weeks remaining before Kenya's 14 million registered voters go to the polls to elect the country's president, his deputy, 290 members of parliament, governors and senators, more than 40 political parties have just handed in lists of their candidates to the Electoral Commission. The candidates were chosen in primaries that were marred by violence, which left hundreds of people seriously injured, especially in Nyanza region, on Lake Victoria Prime Minister Raila Odinga's political stronghold, and in central Kenya, home to Kenya's largest ethnic group, the Kikuyu. The presidential election has attracted six candidates. Three of the front runners are Uhuru Kenyatta, son of Kenya's first president Jomo Kenyatta, Prime Minister Raila Odinga, and one of his deputies, Musalia Mudavadi. Kenyan analysts have predicted that Mudavadi's Western Kenya stronghold will hold a swing vote in case the presidential contest enters the runoff stage. But Mudavadi differs with the analyst.
I think they should forget looking at Western Kenya as a swing vote. Western Kenya is like any other part of Kenya. And we in Amani Coalition are looking for votes all over the country. And I want to tell you that we are gaining a lot of ground and victories in sight.
As Mudavadi predicted victory for his party, businesswoman Mary Wambui Munene defeated prominent politician James Gichuki Mugambi in primaries that will field her to contest Othaya parliamentary seat, which has been held by President Mwai Kibaki for 49 years. This is how a returning officer announced votes collected by Wambui.
Munana Mere Waboy, 13,000.
After the cheers had died down, the cheerful Wambui had this to say.
Othaya people, they have done the best because they have done what they want. Thank you very much.
Primaries in Othaya were important because Mary Wambui was at one time reported to be President Mwai Kibaki's second wife. But the president has vehemently denied the reports, maintaining that he has only one wife, Lucy Muthoni, and not Mary Wambui.
You know, and I know, and everybody else knows that I'm married and I have only one wife.
And in Nyanza region west of Nairobi, Malik Obama, older half-brother to United States President Barack Obama, failed to make it as an independent candidate in primaries for governorship post in Siaya on Lake Victoria.
James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Africa on the Move.
In this week's Africa on the Move, we are in Zambia. According to the World Health Organization, Africa's largest copper producer has the world's second highest rate of cervical cancer and deaths each year. But recent efforts by Zambians and assistance from other countries are helping to turn this around. From Lusaka, Kathy Sikombe with this report.
Being diagnosed with any form of cancer in Zambia 5 years ago was like a death sentence, as the country had no special healthcare facilities to deal with the disease. Those who could afford special treatment traveled abroad, while the majority of the poor remained and died. In 2006, the country built the first ever cancer hospital, which costed $10 million in the capital, Lusaka. The hospital, which deals exclusively with cancer diseases, brought hope to many patients who couldn't afford treatment, as it provides all services for free. Ever since, over 65,000 women have been screened in 17 centers across the capital, Lusaka. Kennedy Lishimpi is the executive director at the cancer hospital. He says the hospital has had a huge impact own cancer patients.
As it stands now, we have seen over 7,000 new cancer cases since the year 2006. And of this number, we have created about 5,000 review cases. These are patients who've been actually received treatment and are now surviving. And some of them have actually been cured from cancer.
Cancer generally develops slowly in the early stages. Before cancer develops, body cells undergo abnormal changes. If detected early enough, most cancers can be easily treated. Lishimpi explains Zambia's progress thus far in the fight against cancer.
Yes, we've made a lot of progress because realizing from the number of patients we have seen in this country, they are coming from all over the country, and we have looked at the age distribution of our cancer patients. We find we have two peaks at which cancers present in Zambia. They are the younger patients between the ages of 25 and 45, and then those above the age of 50.
Odi Soko is a breast cancer survivor who has formed the Zambia Cancer Society to support cancer patients and their families to cope with the disease. Soko, who was diagnosed with cancer 7 years ago, was fortunate to have had her treatment in Germany, as at the time, Zambia had no access to cancer treatment locally.
The objectives of the organization are twofold. One is to provide information about cancer to the general public, and on the other hand, it's to provide psychosocial support to persons who have been affected by cancer.
To help combat the disease, cancer specialists have been trained to offer fast-track testing services and ease the burden of treating minor cancers.
Kathy Sikombe in Lusaka. Now let's turn to the tale of Charles Taylor. Liberian convicted warlord Charles Taylor on Tuesday began his appeal against a 50-year prison sentence handed down by Sierra Leone's UN-backed special court for fueling the West African nation's brutal civil war. Separately, the former president, who resigned in 2003, has caused a political stir back home after he recently wrote a letter to the Liberian parliament accusing the Liberian government of refusing to pay him what he called his legitimate annual pension benefits as stipulated in the country's constitution. Our correspondent in Monrovia, Julius Kanuba, has been following the debate and sent us this report.
Liberia, upper house of parliament, the Senate, publicly heard the communication by Mr. Taylor in its chamber and plans to discuss the matter. In the streets of Monrovia, there was a mixed response to Taylor's demand for a pension.
So he has the right to receive all benefits according to our constitution. Even if you are convicted, you still have right home. You still have right home. You have family.
I think as ex-president of the Republic of Liberia, you deserve your just benefit that every other ex-president deserves as ex-president of the Republic of Liberia. Taylor going to the Hague was not the issue of Liberia. Yeah, the benefit that he deserves as Liberian should not be tampered with.
Even former Liberian president Moses Blah, who took over from Mr. Taylor after his resignation, has joined the debate, confirming that as a former president, he himself is receiving pension benefits from the Liberian government, and that Taylor's demand is in line with the law.
Yes, I received money from the present president of Liberia. She has paid me $2,000 a month. She does that every month. I receive that amount of money. The law says I must have 50% from her salary added to my salary. They must pay this money to President Taylor.
But there are other also different interpretations of the Liberian pension law, with some legal experts arguing that Mr. Taylor does not deserve any benefits because he was forced to resign and was convicted as a war criminal for his backing of rebels during Sierra Leone's brutal civil war. Clarence Fale is a Liberian legal expert.
Mind you, if you are a convict, and by international laws, certain civil rights are diminished. You understand? You cannot be behind bars and expect taxpayers to still be paying you. It's unfortunate.
Taylor resigned as Liberian president in 2003 and fled into asylum in Nigeria.
Julius Kanuba reporting from Monrovia.
making a difference.
As the crisis in Mali continues, Al-Qaeda-linked militants fueled by religious zeal have destroyed historic and sacred sites and banned all forms of music except the Quranic verse in northern Mali. This means the famous festival in the desert, which has been running for more than 10 years, attracting top singers like Bono and Robert Plant, can no longer take place in Timbuktu. But as Tamasin Ford reports from Bamako, musicians and artists say they will not be silenced by the turmoil, and they are fighting back in their own way to make a difference. Take a listen.
A small crowd sits in awe as world-famous choro player Yakuba Sissoko takes to the stage. Pili Pili, a little bar in the heart of Bamako, is not only known for its African food, but also for attracting some of the country's top musicians. Music is at the heart of life in Mali, intrinsically connected to everything. Celebrations, commemorations, and even history is told through songs. But a sinister form of censorship is taking place in northern Mali now. Zuzu, a singer from Gao in the north of Mali, is one of many musicians forced to flee south to the capital, Bamako. Al-Qaeda-linked militants took control of northern Mali after a military coup unseated the democratically elected government last spring. They have since banned music of any kind there, even cell phone ringtones.
I feel very bad. Very bad, because I'm from there, from the north. My parents are there and suffering, and music is suffering too.
The militants have strong ties to criminal gangs, drugs and arms smugglers, but they are also fired by a religious zeal. Extreme forms of Sharia involving stonings and amputations have taken place. Tombs, ancient traditional mud mosques and World Heritage sites have been destroyed, with militants declaring them haram or forbidden in Islam, and official decrees banning all Western music have been issued.
It's like being in jail without any freedom. As a human being, you need freedom to feel like a human being. For the moment, it's not right. It's complicated.
The ban and subsequent death threats on musicians have put an end to the famous festival in the desert, which has taken place every year since 2001 in the northern city of Timbuktu, organised by Mani Ansar.
This is why we are really sad, because we started to build something very important for Timbuktu, for Mali. Having it stopped is really a damage.
Ansar is from Timbuktu. His family are nomadic herders who roam the vast dunes north of the city. His life has been threatened if he goes back. But he hasn't given up. He is still organising the festival, but at a different venue with a different name, the Festival in Exile. It will be a caravan of artists travelling and performing through West Africa.
That report was compiled by Tamasin Ford. Just before we go, a reminder of some of the stories we covered for you in this edition of Africa Link. Britain is considering giving more help to French forces fighting Islamist militants in Mali. Political parties in Kenya on Tuesday began unveiling the names of those who won stormy and chaotic primaries, which observers say were flawed. And Liberia's former president, Charles Taylor, on Tuesday began his appeal against a 50-year prison sentence handed down for aiding and abetting war crimes and crimes against humanity during the civil war in Sierra Leone. That's all we had for you in this edition of Africa Link. Please send us your comments and suggestions by writing to feedback.africa@dw.de or by postal mail to Africa Link, DW53110, Bonn, Germany. Join me same time tomorrow, and from me, Crispin Mwakideu, stay safe.